How you doing, brother?
Hey, man. Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for downloading the app and getting started. I forgot to tell you. I should have told you ages ago, but yeah, thanks for doing that quick. How's your day going?
No, of course. Of course, man. No, just fine. It's exciting times here. We're as soccer fans, we're excited about the Premier League, me and my business partners.
Okay,
but cool. as well, we're... just actually my business partner, who's the head winemaker, Cooper, is on his way back from the High Plains with how many bins, Adrian? How many bins of Malbec are coming?
I think we counted.
They went up with 13, right?
Yeah, but I think they only got 12
and a half. So 12 tons, or did they do a ton each or a ton and a half?
It's 7.5 tons.
Oh, okay, good.
Each bin is...
Okay, good. So we've got 7.5 tons of Malbec coming from the High Plains. It's
wow.
It's incredibly hot right now here. We're in like a major heat wave. And it's been, yesterday was like when we went to practice for soccer, it was 107 at 6 p.m.
No way.
So, yeah, so the bricks, and it's forcing us to, like while we were thinking we were going to get more hang time with the fruit, we're like, oh shit, everything's got to come down right now. So very busy. Yeah, it's fun though.
Crazy. Well, thanks for making a bit of time. I'm excited that you're excited for the Premier League, but do you guys get into rugby at all over there, or is that
actually I went to an all-boys high school in Houston, and we had our rugby team was much more successful than our football team, and we actually had a couple guys who went to play for the U.S. National team.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so we follow it a bit. Like we have a lot, actually, there's like an Aussie rules league and a rugby league here as well. That are sort of like on our same level. And so we have several mates who go and play both of those as well.
That's pretty interesting, because we've got the World Cup coming up.
That's right.
Which obviously I'm crazy for. I'm a huge rugby fan. And I never miss a game with my dad. Now, when England are playing, I honestly can't remember the last time I missed a game. I was close in 2017. I got stranded in Heathrow Airport for about 12 hours on the way back from a business trip from Italy. I was connecting in Heathrow and we got stuck. And then we got kicked out of the airport at midnight and we were told there was no transport on. And England were playing the next day. And I was like, I'm not letting this be the reason I miss a game with my dad. So I got an Uber. From London to Newcastle. So anyone that's listening, that's like,
oh,
I don't know, 300-400 miles, something like that. So this poor guy drove the whole thing. I rounded some strangers up who were heading in the same direction, and we all just shared it. But then he had to drive back as well, this poor guy. And I thought, well, we only paid him like, he only charged £300 or something, which seems really cheap for all the way up to Newcastle and all the way back. But I never miss a game. But I've got this really weird feeling that that the US is gonna take over when it comes to rugby in the next 10 years.
Yeah, there's some big guys, and I think, you know, with the way things are going from a cultural standpoint with American football, with CTE and everything, you know, the tackling form of rugby is you know, when you're not quote unquote protected by you know, the head guard or the helmet, you tackle much more, you know, with better form and not with your face, and you're leading with your head and spearing folks.
Yeah, exactly. So and obviously there's a huge talent pool, and you can afford good coaches and good facilities and stuff, so I've got a good feeling about that. And there's some big names going over to play in your league in the next couple of years. That'd be pretty exciting. So I want to watch my first game of rugby in America in a couple of years' time. I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, you got to get a feel for what the crowd's like.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm excited for the World Cup. So what's going on in the winery then, and how did it all get started? Because I think I spotted you on Instagram because you posted a story of someone skateboarding in the winery. I'm pretty sure that was you.
And yeah, that was.
I've skateboarded since I was about 11, so that's, I don't even know how many years, that's like 19 years probably. And
seemingly unconnected interests, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's weird, but when I saw you, or whoever was it you skateboarding then? Or was it someone else?
There's one of me, but definitely one of Cooper, the taller fellow.
Right.
I think he was trying to, we've got like a rail. So when we're sort of done with the cleanup portion and before we switch it back to all the tables for service in the afternoon and evening, for a bit of fun, you can, you know, it's really nice, clean concrete and a good, you know, modular rail. So
lovely.
It's fun. Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
But the way the winery started, though, Cooper and I had met actually playing soccer in Austin, Texas. He was wearing a shirt that said Hamden, Sydney. And okay. I just thought, I was like, oh, is this like, are you Australian? Without hearing him speak or anything. And apparently, so it's actually, he was like, no, I'm from Virginia. It's an all boys college in Virginia. And I moved down here to get a job in the Texas Hill Country wine industry. And he had just finished uni and I was just on my last year. And I'd come back from studying abroad and I'd worked for a cava producer in Catalonia. Cool. And if you're 2 years old in the central of Texas and you both like soccer and wine, you should probably hang out. So
yeah.
He got me a job out there. Yeah. He got me a job out there and I got him, you know, a soccer team and some friends. And, you know, within a few months, he and I were sort of living together. We went through into sort of different sides of the industry. I went to work for several small producers out in Napa and Sonoma.
Yeah.
And Cooper went to work for an equipment manufacturing, like somebody who imports from Latina and like all the, you know, big European equipment makers. So he really got a good understanding of that. And then on the side, he and I started making individual barrels and small lot wines from the vineyards I was working with. And after just one vintage, we took it to our bosses and we were like, hey, what do you think of these wines? And they thought they were really great. And we asked them if we could quit our jobs and, still use some of the facility. And they were really, really gracious. And so
wow,
that's really, you know, yeah, how it was born.
I love those kind of stories, man. And how old are you now?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love is that there's no like secret barbecue sauce in the wine industry. Like everyone was so generous with their knowledge. And so I really like that sort of apprenticeship approach to it.
I feel like I'm finding the same thing. Like the industry that I came up through starting work as a 17-year-old, it's quite bitter. It can be quite fickle. You know, any opportunity to tear someone else's building down generally gets taken. And I've just kind of evolved with that. And that kind of became how I thought everything was going to be. And then I started getting involved with wine and set this business up and started speaking to some people, met a bunch of merchants, and everyone's just friendly and helpful. Everyone just wants everything to go well for everybody. No one's trying to be like, I'm sure there are people kicking around that are trying to be the biggest and the best and all that kind of thing. But a lot of the time people are just trying to help. And I love that. I really feel like that suits who I am.
Yeah, there's a sort of health of the industry tide, you know, floats all boats sort of thing. And in particular, that's one of the reasons we like we kind of decided to do Texas. When we were first making those wines out in California, we realized very quickly that like the market was extremely saturated.
Yeah.
And one of our like kind of core beliefs was, being albeit that we just make an alcoholic beverage for a living, we wanted to do so in a way that added value to the community. If your business doesn't exist, there should be a loss, right? Yeah. Like, you know, offer something unique. So Austin has such a like high food IQ. People are very farmers markets are very, very well attended. Restaurants like are very quick to note their, you know, where they're sourcing their produce and meats, and people actually like know the ranches and things. So
wow.
With that in, you know, they just really they would still be like, oh, what wine? What do I need? Like a, you know, black tie, mignon? You're like,
yeah.
You're like, no, man, if that's the case, we're only having wine, you know, a couple times a year. And my mom
originally, and you know, I grew up around a much sort of old world approach to wine, where it was like tortellini and brodo, grilled cheese, tennis, and a Pinot Grigio.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm with you.
Yeah, and so that's the same that we kind of take. We don't try and put on an air of false sophistication or something like that. Like we're part of what makes us work in Austin is that we fit with the culture.
Yeah.
And it's wines for this sort of cuisine, climate, and consumer. And so, like, yeah, we skateboard. Cooper listens to metal music. I've got a ponytail and an earring, and we've got tattoos and
brilliant.
Yeah,
I love it, and I think that's important. And I'm kind of the same. And I was vlogging about a chef here in the UK called Gary Usher. I'm only name dropping him because I'm trying to name drop him as much as possible to get him to reply to my messages on Twitter.
Because
I want to collaborate with him and do a pop up wine and food tasting. So I'm just trying to like encircle the guy,
blow him up.
He's covered in tattoos. I'm covered in tattoos. We both swear a lot. I think it'd be a good gimmick if we had a swear jar, you know, if we did do a pop-up thing, because I'm sure we'd raise loads of money for charity, because I'd be trying to beat them. I think there is a bit about that culture. I think trying to bridge it a little bit, particularly in the UK, I think we can be sometimes a little bit divided, like that wine is for these people and that wine's for these people. And I don't mean in terms of snobbery, it's just like, you know, if there's young people drinking natural wine, then that's young people's wine. And other people might go and drink something else that they think is maybe, you know, higher class or something.
What do you think about that? Like, cause I've noticed, that I think that just because of maybe you're in my demographic, like I'm 30, right? So I think say drinkers 25 to 35, what's, you know, call them the younger generation of wine drinkers, are a little quicker on education right now. Like they're plugged into blogs and podcasts like this, where, or, you know, like Wine Folly, resources like that, that give you a bit of exposure to the upcoming trends. Whereas like my dad is like, you know, I've got him off it now, but you know, his friends are basically still sort of like, okay, Bordeaux, Napa Cab, Washington Pinot, Oregon. It's not like they're not quite aware of the natural wine movement. And that's fine, but I think it's coming. At least that's what I've seen from my side.
I agree with that. I agree with the same here. There's more young people plugging into it. We have more interest and orders from younger people. And people who have been plugged into it and been educated and want to try and be careful about the things they put into their body. But not just that in terms of who's making it and why and where the money's going. It's part of my big bet overall for everything that I'm doing, that community business is going to come back in a big way. Everyone's going to want to make sure that every pound or every dollar they spend is going the furthest it can for humans, not big corporates. That's why I think, I mean, we've got Starbucks closing down in our local town. I couldn't be happier. I'm not bothered about that. I couldn't care less about the tax thing. Like, you've seen the headlines, right, that they've avoided.
They've avoided
a lot of tax. I don't care. We didn't have it to begin with. I don't care. What I care about is that people are going to Starbucks because it's a brand and ignore the pop-up coffee shop or the little independent that's down the road that could be doing with. We've got a coffee shop owned by a local roastery. So they're actually importing the coffee, roasting it themselves, and then selling it in their own outlet.
Yeah, that's the best, man. Like that's one thing that I'm seeing more and more. Like I remember, you know, when I went traveling, like as a kid, like one thing that's really depressing, like, is if you go to Puerto Rico, it's like KFC and McDonald's, and like literally, it's like you're hard pressed to find like a local ownership of a storefront, and it's really sad. But then, you know, now I start to travel again, and you know, I see like every little town is sort of pushing out the big boxes, or you know, just by virtue of conscious consumption. I think, you know, it's all well and good for us to be capitalist, but we need to do so consciously. And I think that some of these, you know, bigger corporations, we've just seen the money be sucked out of towns, and you know, the small business ownership has been so low for a long time. that I think people are finally starting to pick up some responsibility, some pride, and you know, some creativity in terms of, you know, producing something for their community. And I see that all over.
I really agree. The only thing that I've got in mind here, and I'm not trying to make a weird political statement, only because I will in a different forum, but what we've got here is landlords, that the landlords of some of the places in the high street might be also local. They might be local government owned property or a local government owned development, and they're just not meeting the rent cost needs of small businesses starting up. There's a there's in one of the towns near here, there's a really high footfall area, and they're wanting $6,000 a month in rent. So whatever that means, 50 grand a year for a brand new business, it's impossible. But on the other side of town where there's no footfall, you can pay $500 a month and start your business quite comfortably.
Yeah. And people, that's another thing that a sort of a motto of mine that I've really taken is, that a lot of people want to get famous before they get good. Right.
Yeah.
So don't start off with, like breaking your budget. I always say, you know, you need to like undercommit and overdeliver.
Yeah.
And you know, I think to our benefit was that we didn't take out any investment. We didn't make promises to anyone.
No.
Didn't borrow anyone's money to get started. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, that's easy to say if you've got a couple $100,000 or something like that. But that really wasn't the case for us.
No.
We had between the two of us, just under $200,000. And part of that was my mom passed away. And right. So, you know, I inherited just a bit, and I wanted to be in control of my investment. I knew it was something she would be proud of, and that sort of, you know, the will of her legacy really like drove me to like, all right, I'm not going to fail, right?
Yeah.
But we started with, you know, fuck all for equipment. We didn't even have a forklift for our first year and a half.
No,
we didn't have running water in our winemaking facility. So, Brett and I built scaffolding, dragged a big IBC water tote up to like the top of it, and then ran it through a hot water heater to clean it, and like filled it with a hose, you know, from the garden.
Wow.
So you know, if you can make good wine with bad equipment, then you've earned the right to go forward.
Yeah.
You know,
I love stuff like that. And I agree entirely. I've been talking recently about, you know, I've got three businesses going now, and I haven't raised any money for any of them. And I don't think it's a smart move, because all it does, I think, is just changes the gears that you're in. It just means it got to sell more to cover that and still make money.
Right. And then you can't be creative in yourself when you have that stress.
Yeah. Cause you've got to work for the bank.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. For the underwriters.
That's it. And I'm just not a big fan of it. And that's why I quite like how everyone's doing something really small scale. There's a guy, you'll probably see a guy called Will Davenport, who makes some wine over here, right? He started real small, and he's still real small in comparison. Makes some ridiculous wine, and he's now presenting it in these really cool, like, handmade wooden boxes someone got me off my birthday a couple of months ago. I love that feel, and I'm sending his bottles of wine whenever we do something for free. We just gifted this really cool influencer from Bristol called Lois two bottles, and whenever I do anything for free, I give someone a bottle of Will's wine, because it just personifies everything I think I'm trying to do with this brand and with the business and everything that's going to happen after that, but also just what all of the wine's about, so that you can actually learn to like the wine or see what there is and see what the difference is taste-wise. Going back to what you said earlier on, there's so many people I know that are still buying, I can't remember what wine it is, there's something advertised crazy heavy, prime time on a night. It's a red wine. Can't remember who makes it.
Real like, middle. Like a meat... Miomi or something like that.
No. It's it'll come to me in a minute. People buy me it all the time as gifts. Like, that's the one thing I found, that people, oh, you're into wine, here you go. And it's not what I was expecting, but okay, I'm very grateful. And people are paying like £9-10 for this wine, and from the superstore, and I'm thinking, this is really expensive, all retail. Like, there's no, the winemaker's getting none of this.
No,
And it's not that nice. but because it's got a bit of a price tag on it compared to the £4 Liebfrau Milch or whatever, like everyone thinks it's the best wine ever.
A bit posh.
And like, right. I quite like the process of education about wine, and it doesn't, something on your website got me. It says snob free. I haven't been brave enough to actually say those words, but that's exactly what I'm aiming for. I want you to learn about what these wines are and why they taste better and why the whole process is nicer to the environment, to the humans that drink it, to the winemakers. And I think we're getting to a point where the dog's back in control. I don't know how the supermarkets work over there, but from what I understand here, the major supermarkets will go and buy 2 years 2 years product from a winery.
Yeah, so actually I'll just give you a quick little insight into that, the economics and the sort of push and pull there. So you know Whole Foods, right?
The Amazon, so Whole now, Foods, right?
Actually, just by Amazon. So they started in Austin, Texas, and this is its headquarters. And you know they do, you know, they mark things up a lot. They have some really high quality things, but the markup is considerable.
Yeah.
But for us, when we first started going into like wholesaling, you know, you say whatever, say a bottle of wine retails for $20, right?
Yeah.
We'll wholesale that at usually about 40% to 50%. So that's a considerable, you know, discount, really, just to have your wine on someone's shelves so that they can make, you know, the same amount as you on it, right? So that's always one thing that makes, like, especially for a winery under 7,500 cases, you need to sell 75% direct to consumer for you to generate profit.
Wow.
So in other words, it's very rare that you're going to find, it has to be a very like dedicated retailer that's open to having wines become sold out, to switching SKUs, to, you know, revolving diversity on the shelves, that's going to carry, you know, unique wines. If it's in, you know, one of these big box stores and it's not, you know, listed as seasonal or something that's going to quick fire sell out, it's generally a mass production, you know, over 20,000 cases of an individual SKU wine. And I think when you get to that point, it's very difficult to maintain something that's truly, truly like unique. I'm not totally anti big wines. I think, you know, there's some that do it well, but for me, I think that when you're in these smaller lots, when the vineyard is, you know, one location, there's so much more like subtlety to that flavor than sort of, you know, a cacophony of like, you know, lots of different sourcing for one wine that sort of becomes a bit bland.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I agree with you. I'm not against big wine either particularly, but what I'm struggling with is we have this, apparently, I haven't seen this in person, so I don't want to say for certain, but there's a retrospective price decrease that some of the big box stores can apply. So if they want to buy your wine and sell it for $8, but then it's not selling $8, they want to make it $6, they're going to take that from what they're going to pay you for the second year, not from their margin. So that they're trying to maintain their margin for that kind of thing.
You're right. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot. I sort of got off there. But yeah, on that. So for instance, with the Whole Foods thing, like we actually, I fought hard to get our wines into the downtown, the main headquarters, Whole Foods.
Right.
And sure enough, we get in, and we've got like two wines that have been like heavily cladded with metals, which, you know, for whatever it's worth, right? That gives good prestige and it gets people onto them. And so it was for two wines that won a gold medal and a silver at the Houston International Wine Competition.
Cool.
Called Violet Crown and Workhorse. One is sort of like a Rhone style blend and one's a more of a Bordeaux style.
Cool.
But they, as a result, they sold out like immediately. And we're like, hey, well, we don't have another vintage coming around for, you know, 4 months. We're not going to push it if it still needs time to age. And we basically lost our spot on the shelves. Like, they're like,
well, permanently.
Well, you know, and that, well, I mean, like they're not, the wines aren't there right now.
No.
The new vintage is just about to come out, but it's sort of like, okay, then I have to go fight that again
to get them to sell my wine at a discount, you know, and they're going to like mark it up. So it's one of those things where it's like, it's part of the struggle of growing, because, you know, you want people to have exposure to these wines. We want people to understand Texas wine, you know, the same way we want people to understand natural wine and organic wine, but it takes a personal relationship with, and I think the smaller stores and on-premise, you know, neat little bars with educated bartenders and people who care about wine are going to move the buck much quicker than it being on a shelf in Whole Foods or Costco or Sainsbury's.
Sure. And as well, depending where you end up in that price range in those big box places, you might just end up, the actual consumers of your wine might just be people, and I blog posted about this the other day, they might just end up becoming people who are drinking wine to get drunk. If you end up in that price range, I was trying to say that wine should always be part of the entertainment. It's not that you go and buy a bottle to drink the whole bottle and feel wobbly by the end of the evening and repeat every day. That's just abusing
wine.
I'll
tell you. Yeah, agree. And you know, I always forget, or I try to remind myself that we can't expect everyone to be as passionate about wine as I am.
No.
And I had an old boss who told me, he was like, you know, if you take a girl out on a date and you spend more than 45 seconds talking about the wine at a time, you're doing it wrong. It's not about the wine.
Yeah.
Like, the wine is here to enhance, you know, your food, your conversation, your company, music, whatever, you know, it's a sensory engagement. And it should be an accessory. It's great on its own, but it should be paired with something.
100%, always. Even if you just, I mean, I've had some really fantastic wines recently as I've been on this journey. Actually, I've got an empty bottle of Susukari. You probably saw it on my stories because I posted it about 20 times. Another good example of the wine industry. Obviously, not many of these bottles made it to the UK, and technically one of our competitors sold me two bottles that were clearly for my consumption. Like, it's just people being nice. So shout out to them.
Yeah.
I had this with takeaway pizza. I don't think.
Oh yeah, I watched that one.
Yeah.
I saw that.
I don't think you have to be like, you know, someone once, I can't remember who it was, when I said I was opening this business, they were like, oh, you've got to get your food and wine pairings right. I don't think it can be that fixed. It's all subjective.
No.
You can like good wine with crap food, you can like good wine with takeaway, you can have bad wine with good food and it'll probably make the wine good.
In that variability, my brother's in fashion, and so I kind of liken it to how people style themselves differently, or what color palette works for you, right? Like I think, you know, people have got their own like manner of comfort, right? Like, I'm really sensitive to like sugar. Like, I really, really am averse to it.
Right.
In wine, of course, I think most of us are that way, unless we're starting out. But I really love spice, right? So I always over like spice my food, and I like high acidity wine too, which kind of, you know, which you consider as, ooh, that's bad, you know, it's going to enhance it. But like, for me, I'm like Thai food and a wine with crisp acidity and minerality that like makes it burn a bit more. Like, for me, that goes, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
That's sort of a bit of a no-no, you know?
Well, I always ask for my gin and tonics made spicy. If I go to somewhere that's making like real good gin and tonics with good gins and good mixes, I always say, I don't want it sweet. And one of these ones with fruit hanging out of it and things floating in it. I just want the spiciest gin you're going to make me. Chili flakes, you can put whatever you want in there. That's how I want it to be. And everyone kind of looks at me funny, like, you don't want one of these fruity ones full of raspberries? Well, no, I don't.
Yeah.
I'm just not down with that at all.
No framboise. Yeah.
So how much of a risk was it then, that 200,000? Were you like, and I'm getting this from a business point of view.
Yes.
More than a wine point of view. You know, I'm obsessed with people that take ridiculous risks. I think it's really cool. There's someone I know who took a massive risk, you know, way back when. He's lauded as one of the best businessmen in our area now. But at the time, I'm sure if I'd have known him then, I'd have been saying, it's a big risk. But it gets me excited when people are taking these ridiculous risks and doing things that they might not be able to do or that might not work. So how did you feel when you were right about to do it?
Oh, you know, I about threw up. But at the same time, I felt very confident. You know, you're sort of getting these really mixed emotions, and you know, you realize very quickly, like, and I am naturally a very emotional person, but I realized very quickly, like, I just needed to, like, stay the course, be very level, and focus on, like, what I could change.
Yeah.
And you know, so having this sort of, like, I really actually liked pushing, you know, I'm pushing time in my livelihood to, you know, wine in a region that was not yet really known for it, and still really isn't. There's tons of market share to go. But I sort of stuck to my book course of, like, what I knew the market liked, and what I knew the trends would be, and where it would go. And that really, like, if you have a strong foundation of beliefs that are driving you, then I think you'll be discouraged at times, but you always know, like, you can convince yourself, like, no, I can do it. So for us, one of the biggest risks was deciding to use all Texas fruit, because, you know, there's much less planted acreage. There was sort of a bit of insecurity as to, like, the quality across the board that we could make. Like, there was a major risk that we were afraid we couldn't have a full diverse portfolio of wine from just Texas fruit. Okay. Yeah, and so that was, like, sort of the first hurdle, was making sure that we could convince vineyard owners and managers to let us manage the vines, you know, with you know, removing drip irrigation, doing dry irrigation, picking for acidity rather than, there was, like, that was sort of, I always go, like, product first. So yeah. I think there's a big risk for, in terms of that. Right. But then just the entire uphill battle, like, self-distributing, like, it just becomes, you know, one thing to another. You know, are we going to have the equipment? How are we going to do this? Like, you know, in the early days, Cooper and I were like driving trucks with macro bins, you know, which we certainly weren't credited to do.
Yeah.
But you know, you just try and, like, bootstrap everything.
Yeah.
Focus on what you're good at, and then you're like, okay, let's figure out what I'm worst at in this business, and offload it, or, you know, bring someone on who can handle it.
Yeah, definitely. I do the same thing. The most important thing for me is maths. I've got to have someone around me really close who can do maths, because I'm really, really bad at it. Like ridiculous bad. We had 20 chicken nuggets the other day. Someone ate 6 and I thought there was 18 left. Like, yeah. I really struggle with the way numbers relate to each other. If someone isn't adding up or checking my work, it turns into a disaster. But I know what you mean, and what everything I'm doing is much smaller scale in terms of risk. I'm dead against risking startups. I've got a bit of a theory that unless you're expecting a ridiculous influx of cash through sales in the UK, you should, and you're starting something up from scratch that's doing something even remotely similar to many other businesses, you've got to start maximum 10 grand. I don't think you can.
Yeah.
We're so full of little startups that are all doing similar things at the moment, and they're all going and leveraging themselves. There's a competitor of ours in another industry that I'm in, who they've just borrowed loads of money, and they're not doing that much better than us, but it looks like they are.
Right. Like, yeah. From a market.
Yeah.
I know exactly that feeling. So one thing actually that I just, you got me thinking on is, I sort of, and I noticed you're doing this very much, as well, is you take a look at what's going on and what, like, market are you sort of disrupting or, giving a new look to, what's everyone doing there? And you sort of go to do the opposite. So for instance, in Texas, hill country wineries, which are about, like, 45 minutes to an hour and a half away, at the time that we came to existence, in 2013, there were already 25 out on that trail. Now there are 52.
Whoa.
52 wineries, but they're all 45 minutes to an hour and a half outside of Austin. They call it the hill country, and people sort of go, you know, on the weekend with their girlfriends
bachelorette parties and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And my sort of thinking was, all right, if our vineyards are far away, like between an hour and a half and 6 hours away, and we're going to have to bring all of these different vineyards to one site to do the production, why don't we do it in the city where people can have easy exposure? They don't have to, like, you know, the risk is, all right, people aren't going to spend, if you don't know you like wine, or how often are you going to go drive an hour and a half to spend all day drinking wine if you're not even sure you're into it? So having the production facility and the room in the urban atmosphere allows for people to come, you know, just on a whim. Allows us to pair it with, you know, concerts and, you know, other interests to get people the exposure. And so I think, like, what you're doing similarly is this hyper personalized subscriptions where, you know, it looks like, you know, you really tailor it to each customer as well. And you don't see that, like, look at the big wine clubs that are going on online right now that they're really pushing. And it's no personalization. It's mass wines, just, you know, now they've just delivered it to your door and you're on a subscription service, right? It's not changed it.
And it's just getting thrown at you. And it's the best part is about it is really cheap.
Yeah.
You know, they're putting in like £15 wines that they're knocking out for £5 in some of these subscriptions because they're buying so much of it and they're controlling so much of the product coming out through the subscriptions. There's someone that lives opposite me. I can see their house from the window here. They're subscribed. They know about my business, but they're subscribed to another wine club that isn't organic or natural or anything like that. And every time the delivery van comes, I make a point of standing outside just so they know that I've seen it. And they'll buy eventually, I'm sure. But I said the same to them. Like, you're just getting wine thrown at you. You don't really know what you're ordering. We're giving you some recommendations. You know, I want to try and give people opportunity to try things they've never tried. The first couple of months of subscription with us, you don't get to pick a damn thing. You're getting stuff. Because I don't want someone to be like, oh, I tried a Merlot once.
Yeah, come in with their preconceived notions, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that, you can choose, or I'll help you choose, and we can talk about these things, or I can show you some of the pieces of content we've created on video or text, which are that give you my opinion on some of these wines. You can then make an informed decision on whether you like that. There's that. Have you seen that Armador, the Norwegian shipping wine?
Yeah, yeah.
Totally not. You could tell it was well made. It was a nice wine, but that taste of licorice came through real hard. And I don't like licorice.
Yeah, it's just, so for you, it's like, okay, knowing that, exactly. It's like the same thing with, I think, good food critics. Like, they make their critics as well, make their, like, hey, look, here's like we were talking about. Okay, you don't want like a fruity gin and tonic. So, you know, if I'm reviewing a fruity gin and tonic, I'm going to mention that, you know, internal bias right there. But, yeah, you know, for you to determine from there. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of had two points to make there. The first one is I've just looked at how expensive the flights are from my local airport to get to Austin. And they're way cheaper than I expected. They're like 400 and something pounds, £413.
No way.
Yeah, I know. I was expecting way more than that. Actually, you were here recently. What did you pay to get here?
Yeah, actually, I paid a bit. It was one of my best friends who just got married this weekend, who you saw us drinking the Talisker.
He's
a good guy. He's Scottish heritage. I'm a McLaughlin, and he's a MacDonald. So
cool.
We went to the Highlands for his bachelor party. And so we came through London, but we only had about a 3-hour layover, and I had a good friend. I used to work in, I clerked for like a solicitor for a couple summers, and so I just ran into the city just to have a pint with him. And it was actually, ironically, it was like London Wine Week,
right?
Or English Wine Week. So I drank like something from the coast of, from like down by Dover, which was nice and crisp. But I was just here for a moment, but it cost me, I think I spent like £800, but that was going all the way to Inverness.
Yeah, it's not too bad actually travel wise, but you know, once you're here getting trained and stuff, our train system is ridiculously expensive and, in my opinion, poor quality if you compare it to the rest of Europe. Do you do all that full visit the winery, explore, have something to eat?
So that was one of the things. So after 3 years, we sort of, and we call it like proof of concept, but like we were actually generating profit year two and three, which is, you know, by winery standards, pretty crazy. But with that, we were able to raise a bit of money, and we had some profit, $250,000, and we built out this whole facility, which is like a giant warehouse build with a big glass roll up, concrete floors, concrete bar on one end, tanks opposite you, but in the same room. And then at the back of the space is the barrel room, glassed off, you know, visible, and then like a little mezzanine above it. So yeah, it's really, really casual, comfortable, does really well for events, but anyone can drop in. We do no reservations unless it's a private event. And yeah, tastings are, you can have glass of wines by the glass from like 6 to 12, you know, cheese, charcuterie, tastings. And we don't charge any like corkage fee. So the price you pay for a bottle, you know, to go, you could have it here as well. So
man, as long as we talk here with you, I'm coming. That sounds like that sounds like an amazing trip.
Come, we'll put you up as well.
That'd be amazing. Thank you. I love that kind of thing. I'm watching a maker down in Candania Hastings, if you know where that is. It's called Rye. Tillingham Wines, have you seen them yet?
No, I'm just looking it up now.
So the guy behind it, I think he was like one of the senior guys at Gusborne. And then he started this Tillingham Wines. I found them fairly early on Instagram, and they're doing the same thing. They're trying to make the coolest come and visit experience. And I was on the phone with the guy the other day, just chatting through some ideas, and I really like that vibe of creating a real experience. I think we can use that to lean into the retail sector on the high street, certainly in the UK, maybe in the US too. Your retail store's got to be an experience. Like, it's not just about coming and buying a bottle of wine. It's coming and tasting things and seeing things and hearing things and meeting the owners.
So this guy's wines look really hit, man. Like, just the branding on it. And he's got a pet net. It looks like he's doing things in Kiviari, which...
He hasn't, because I tried to order some and it's sold out. So he hasn't got a pet net. He's working on some. I think they were bottling yesterday. Reserving. I want to reserve at least a bottle of that.
But I really like the vibe. Yeah, it's really
so,
cool.
I just want to help people that are doing cool things as well and get involved with people who are doing that kind of thing. So, we'll figure that out. What did the fires, as bad as they were in California, how did that affect what you're doing?
So actually, what's very sad is that was actually Santa Rosa, which is where I was based. I was working for a winemaker named Adam Lee. Who owns Siduri and Novi Fan Wines, or he sold Siduri, but he was adopted by a woman in Austin when he was a kid, and when I was out in California, he heard there was a guy from Austin starting to try and start a winery there. He allowed me. He was like, "Hey, why don't you come and work with me, and I'll let you use my space, because you know, until you're bonded, you can't make any legal wine in Texas, but you can make wine here in my facility in California, and then, you know, move it there." So really,
that's so cool.
Yeah, insanely generous with me. Like, you know, I owe him so much. Unfortunately, pretty much, you know, half the town of Santa Rosa burned, much of really high quality Sonoma vineyards, and you know, everything that was in the winery, because power was out. Everyone had to leave, you know, so much smoke damage. It was really, really tragic. It didn't affect me. It didn't affect our business anymore, since everything we do is in Texas, but it's just sort of tragic to see. And thankfully, you know, they had insurance and all that, but it's sort of like the hard work and sort of the sweat that you put into it that you don't really get to reap. I don't think any of us ever want to, you know, put work into art or music or, you know, wine and then, or livestock and then, you know, get an insurance check or something. That's really, it just sort of doesn't feel good.
It's not really the same, is it?
No.
And doing the second iteration of it, you know, yeah, okay, things like that become part of the history of a business when it gets really old.
Yeah.
And become, you know, part of the legend, if you like. But in the immediate aftermath of a loss like that, I don't think it feels very nice to go and do it again.
What was good was there was, and we actually did like a little fundraiser for it, but there was, especially because so much of the vineyard workers are migrant workers, and many of whom happen to be, you know, undocumented or in a sort of limbo status. And so there was a great fear at the time from that community about going to these sort of shelters and resource centers because they were afraid that they would also like be like nipped, you know? So there was several charities that were set up that sort of offered, you know, kind of the government equivalent resources from a private sector that didn't, you know, take any of that data and would, you know,
just anonymous.
Yeah, exactly right. So that was one initiative that I thought was really good. And, you know, these sorts of things, all communities really come together. And you know, the wine community being as tight as it is, I think they were well served to help their neighbors.
Such a cool story that you've got a link to that, though, you know, from starting making wine over there. I bet that was a weird feeling, but it's also quite a nice part of the story, and hopefully they can rebuild it and that all becomes part of the legend, and you can talk about that in 10 years time when, you know, everything's put back together. That'd be interesting to see. What do you guys do about sulfites in your wines? Are they different? Are you trying to keep them under a certain threshold? What are you doing with levels?
And I think that also kind of goes to the point about micro and macro production. So, you know, with the giant producers like Bogle and McManus and those of the world, when they're transferring wine to tank, there's a lot of oxygen exposure just, you know, by virtue of the amount of time it takes and how big these, you know, tanks are and how much wine they're moving, that they have to sulfite up the wine a lot to protect it from oxidation. With us, we're only doing 6,000 cases a year, and it's across 14 different SKUs. So our biggest production wine is like 700, 800 cases. So nothing is in a significant like risk in when it's being transferred. So we really don't do any sulfite addition. We try and we, you know, check the levels. Really the lowest that you'd be comfortable with bottling is really like 20 parts per million. I think humans have like 50 parts per million in us. It keeps us from rotting. But, you know, really, as long as you've the wine has been cared for, the sulfite, like the free SO2 level in it, shouldn't be that much of a concern. Alcohol and acid help protect the wine. So does tannins. So if you don't filter it, you're also better suited against sort of SO2 falling off the table and oxidation. So that's how we approach it.
That's cool. I'm interested because I'm trying to keep the stuff we do as much as possible to the low and no added sulfite levels. So it's tough because they come with a bit more of a price tag because they're exactly what you've just described. About how small the batches are. So we've started playing around with a few. There's also some wines that are just outside of that. So I think Will Davenport's Horsmanden's just gone up to 78, I think, from 74. And now can't class as that. And I don't know what the state is over there, but over here, I think there's a little bit of... let's say there's a bit of defense around classifications, qualifications. You know, there's a big thing about what the definition of natural wine may or may not be.
Yeah.
And people get really, like, you know, heated. really up about it. And I don't think it makes that much difference. Like, it's tough.
For me, like, the certifications and are all well and good. Like, you know, there's a really strong organic certification that's very popular in California, but it's incredibly expensive to get. And, you know, just because it's the same with, you know, your DOC or DOC or, you know, your ASC regulations. Yeah. It's like, if you're not a by the book Catholic, then you're not, you know, then you're not in, right? So, and I think that that's sort of wine. So much of this is an exploration. And what I see, like, just from this guy in Tillingham, you know, using Kivera, and we use Amphora a lot, like going to these sort of low tech is high tech old ways of making wines, I think is really fun and explorative, but it's going to challenge some existing myths of the wine industry, and there's always going to be pushback, so you know, it's okay.
I'm quite happy with I think where there's pushback, there's usually something good going on, because someone's trying to fight over the ground. So I quite like that space. I agree with you on the organic stuff. Obviously the European organic logos on all these bottles that I'm looking at that are scattered about in front of me now. One thing I did hear about it, though, you to convert to organic, apparently you have to wait 3 years. So you have to waste 3 years crop. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, it's
it surprised me that. Is it the same there then?
I don't know if it's if it's quite the same, but I know you do have to leave crop fallow for a bit, and to get biodynamic certification as well. It's like it's pretty much. It makes it to the point where it's out of price range for a small producer to do it because they simply aren't capable. But the big guy who, you know, maybe doesn't actually, you know, I'm not going to say they don't care, but like maybe they're doing it for the certification. Like they can, you know, they want the badge, right? Like, and they can afford to do it. So it sort of creates a weird, weird little break there.
True. I'm going to try and wrap it up now because we've been going for a bit. Not least because I've got a bit of training to do, but you've got, you know, a whole day of work ahead of you now. What's the time difference? Is it 5 hours for?
I think six. I'm at just before 11.
Okay. So I'm just at coming up to 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I've got a bit of training to do, but just on the last thing I was going to ask you, one of the things I'm trying to do is find some really interesting wines that we can bring as like real not exclusive, but, you know, short term offers for our customers, but stuff that they're not going to really get anywhere else or in a slightly different format.
Yeah.
I know we had a couple of messages about it. You don't have to feel like you have to say it, you know, on record here, but I'd love to try and get, you know, the right logistics and the right licensing because our licensing is interesting here. And find a way that we can just get, I don't know, a handful of bottles. Maybe if we give them away, if we buy them and give them away, you know.
Or if you know, I gift them to you, send them over the pond, and you know, we just do it as a personal gift, and then you can pass it wherever you like.
Yeah, I guess so. That's it. I mean, from a licensing point of view, we don't have a licensed premises here. Because of the structure we've got, the merchants we've partnered with are dispatching the wine.
Right.
So I have a personal license to give authority to sell alcohol, but they have the premises license, so we can't sell it from here.
Yeah.
So we're working with a couple others at the moment where we're trying to find a way that we can get the merchant to sell it for us, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
But otherwise, if there's a way we can gift it or do something like that, I'd love to figure that out and expose some people in the UK to some of your stuff. I'm sure we've got one customer and a friend who she grew up on a vineyard in New Zealand, in the family vineyard, and then moved over to the UK, and she knows what wine's all about. So I'd be interested to see how she found it. Get a review from someone like her. That'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be really great. And I don't have any immediate plans to come over at the moment, but My business partner, who handles all of the accounting, administration, and everything, his both his parents are from Manchester.
Not far.
And they just bought a house, or like little cottage, like just outside of London. They're at retiring age, and they're tired of the States, I think. We'll certainly, at least if not me, he'll be going over there before like Christmas time. So cool. If we can send some wine to you before then, we'll definitely do that. But I think we could bring some and have some live time too.
That sounds like a good idea to me, man. But I bet before then I'll end up in Austin before then.
Good.
If you're putting that kind of offer forward, man, I'm up for it. All I have to figure out is, I've never traveled with a skateboard before, so I have to figure out how I'm supposed to carry that.
Oh, you carry it on. You're good to carry it on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Wherever I've needed them, I've just bought them when I've got there. So that's what I'll do. And I'm going to try and I'm looking at that for September, October. That's going to be my next adventure for sure.
That'd be great. We actually, have an Austin Winery logo deck we got custom done.
No way.
Yeah, which I highly recommend. It was well worth it. It'll give you the website and make a custom One Day Wednesday one.
Yes, that's super cool. I'm up for that.
Yeah.
Nice one. Well, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
Dude, awesome. Thank you so much. As well. This is the good side of people connecting on the internet, right?
For sure. That's what it's all about, man. That's what it's all about. You have a good day. I'm going to go get some training done.
See you, mate. Bye.
See you, brother.